Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The geological evidence of nano diamonds that they found all over the Earth, which suggests, according to the University of Santa Barbara, that a huge comet probably impacted in the ocean or North Atlantic ice sheet 12,000 years ago, 11,000 years ago. Well, then it all actually does make perfect sense.
Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy by Michael LaFlemme. Michael's website, michaellaflemme.com. That's LEFLEM.com. The audiobook is also available. That's on Audible. Michael is a researcher and a history and philosophy professor, also a columnist for New Dawn magazine. What I like about the book is he includes some esoteric material, channeled material, Frederick Oliver. Edgar Cayce's also included Rudolf Steiner, Barbara Hanclough. It just makes a fascinating overview of Atlantis.
I've read your book. I also did the audiobook, and you were kind enough to send me the information, and this is what I thought was so profound, the information on Frederick Oliver. You warned me that it was going to be kind of dense. I mean, like, as in super intense dense. I have to admit, I'm still working my way through it. So let's back up. Visions of Atlantis is the book, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy by Michael LaFlemme. I really love the book. Okay, so what did you get with the response for the audiobook?
Well, thank you for that. We sold quite a few copies, actually more than the print book in half the time it's been out. So that was really nice to see. You know, was fortunate enough to find the way these things work, actually a narrator who happened to be an expert on ancient history and biblical history and could speak and read three different ancient languages. So it was a real pleasure to go through the process with him, and it's the first audiobook I had ever created. So yeah, I was pleased by it, and we have some pretty cool sound effects and little surprises in there to keep you on your toes. It reads like a really, you know, it can be broken up. It doesn't have to be listened to like a novel all the way through. It's actually a great thing to put on for an hour or two. If that's too much for you, or you get to a mystery that you need to listen to again, you can always go back. A lot of books are pretty hard to translate into audiobooks, but I like the way this came out.
Well, there's a change up with the voices and the music. So you have a little bit more of a drama part that is interspersed in there,
yeah,
to keep it lively, keep
right.
It fresh.
Yeah, and it's a story that has its own internal drama. So we felt like, look, if we're going to be talking about a comet hitting the Earth, hey, we got to put a little bit of grease on that. And if we're going to have Edgar Cayce in a trance, well, you know, I'm going to step in for that piece and have my little creepy cameo. Chris handled the rest very well. So, yeah, I was really pleased. And you know, it's great because a lot of people, understandably, are busy or, you know, just prefer listening to audiobooks when they travel or at the gym and stuck in traffic, etc. So it's nice that we finally have all formats out, hardcover, file cover, Kindle now, and audiobook, as well as a website that has a lot of great links, actually, to some of the sources that I used in the book. And just some recommendations, you know, some bibliographies, and if anybody's curious, some quite hard to find collected files from the Edgar Cayce Foundation, actually, the ARE, that has like all of his readings on ancient Egypt, all of his readings on the first fall of Atlantis and stuff. So, you know, I wanted to show people where I got a lot of this stuff so that they can continue, if they're interested, the research, you know, which is really endless. I think eventually you get to the point where it's an endless search, you know, and I think that's much more important than any kind of conclusive I found it type argument, which I never really subscribe to myself. You know, this is a global culture that likely lasted over 50,000 years. The best we can do is try to piece together Humpty Dumpty instead of declaring boldly, look at this, it's here. No, it's there. No, it's in Ohio. No, it's in Mauritania. No, it's in the Azores. It's like probably had traces in all of these places. And we should just look at the original stories and try to the best of our ability, extrapolate out from primary source material and use, if we can, reliable, quote-unquote, esoteric or channels or past life regression transcripts to fill in gaps to the best of our ability. I think that's all we can do with this subject.
Well, I like the fact that you're using some of the channel material, because a lot of people, they discount that immediately, but it's like reincarnation. That's been discounted by Western society, and they're finding that maybe they need to rethink that, because some of the most recent cases that have been documented show that there is more to this, and the other Eastern cultures have been doing this for hundreds, if not more, of years, and finding correlations. So to discount it outright, I think, is unfair.
I think it's absolutely unfair, and I always remind people that even Christianity, you know, before its many revisions, did speak of this. If you really pay attention closely to a few passages from the New Testament, take, for example, you know, the work of some recent past life regressionists, like Dolores Cannon, who regressed thousands of people over the past 30 years. I mean, read her books, read The Convoluted Universe, and see if reincarnation is fake. Although it's impossible, of course, to prove in, you know, the same quote-unquote scientific method and prove other things, it's not hard to look at, as I did with the Casey being, to look at an aggregate, for example, take both of those people, take 30 years of Edgar Casey readings where he put himself in a hypnagogic trance, take 30 years of Dolores Cannon readings where she's wide awake with a recording device, progressive people that don't know each other, have no knowledge of these time periods, and look at what they're all saying. And it's unbelievable. And in fact, it's, to me, demonstrably proof that there was some reality called Atlantis, because people who have never spoken about it or heard of it before, who laughed about subjects like this when regressed, begin suddenly recalling past lives that are eerily similar from a similar time period, including a migration to Egypt or other parts of the world at a certain date. That's very difficult to call pure chance. In fact, it's disingenuous to say that these people are all just making stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and the thing I find fascinating is that you included a lot of the stuff from Edgar Casey that might be, as you said, difficult to hunt down. And some of it, the people, the list of recognizable names like Einstein and Tesla. What is also noted is that they went by numbers, so you couldn't exactly, you know, peg it to a specific person, but you could approximate the date and the time and the type of information and make a reasonable guess.
Yes, that's right. We know almost certainly that Nikola Tesla had at least one past life reading with Edgar Casey. And if it's the reading we think it is, then Casey was very explicit telling him, you absolutely were in Atlantis, you were a very powerful person back then, and you're bringing that knowledge back into this timeline. We absolutely know that Woodrow Wilson, former president, set up the League of Nations, had a reading with Edgar Casey, along with Henry Ford, along with many other powerful people. So this wasn't just some quack. This was a person that had a multi-year waiting list and gave 15,000 life readings over the course of 40 years, and never asked for money. And so when you see these things, I use him for a variety of reasons. Number one, there's no motive for him to be making this up. Number two, he's the most accurately studied by people who were skeptics of any of these people. He had people like Dr. Harmon Breaux, who at the time was an atheist and a complete skeptic, who visited Casey a couple of years before he died and witnessed 600 of these readings. and wrote a book about that experience and showed absolutely, not just with past life things, because you can't prove that, but Casey could find objects in real time that nobody could find. You know, he could tell people, for example, there's three of these certain colonic irrigation machines in this region of Texas where he lives. He's saying this in 1945. There's no way for him to go Google this, check this, even really call and find these things, let alone know where the person who he's being told is the client even lives, because they don't tell you where this person lives. They just say client XYZ or to give you a name. And yet, this doctor was able to verify that he was doing this reliably, or he was finding mineral deposit levels at the exact depth in the ground that later was confirmed when people went drilling. You know, and so I use him as a very reliable source. And when it comes to specifically his dating of different timelines, like the final iteration of Atlantis and the emigration to Egypt, again, he picks very specific dates. You know, he says Great Pyramid was built 10,490 BC. And again, it's a very strange date for a man in 1932 to pick, because at that time, nobody, to my knowledge, had ever suggested a date of that length. But we now know through the work of people like Graham Hancock, Robert Bobal, Robert Schock, many others, that indeed there is compelling and quite serious evidence that that actually is a more likely date for the creation of specifically that object, and that this date that we give it in late dynastic Egypt, early dynastic Egypt, and being built by Pharaoh Khufu, is absolutely unverifiable. In fact, there's only one reason people even claim that, because a 19th century explorer who likely wrote this himself claims to have found with zero witnesses the word Khufu in one of the chambers in red ochre. Again, I tell people all the time, there is no record of this building construction in dynastic Egypt. In a culture that preserved records of everything, there is no record of the Great Pyramid, which should suggest that they inherited it in dynastic times. When you look at the results of people like Dolores Cannon's past life regression, she regresses people who say, I remember leaving Atlantis and I'm coming to Egypt, and we're restarting civilization, and I'm seeing what looks like a pyramid, or I'm seeing the thing in 10,500 BC. And none of these people knew Edgar Casey readings or anything. But again, I go back to Casey because it's very easy and understandable to say, well, modern channelings are just copying his readings. And I understand that's possible. So I take you back to not just Casey, but like you said, I'll take you back to 1886. And show you a kid on the frontier who's 17 years old who's talking about holographic cell phones, talking about flying machines that can go underwater, talking about anti-gravity levitation devices. And this is a kid who lives in 1886 on the California frontier, who again puts his own date of the past life he's channeling at 11,000 BC. And again, it's like, why do these numbers keep coming up if this is all just make-believe? And I think it's because it's not make-believe. In fact, it's pointing to what geologists and archaeologists are largely coming to believe now, is that a terrible cataclysm befell the Earth around 10,000 BC and wiped out whatever culture had existed on this planet and only left us fingerprints like the megalithic architecture or stories that were preserved. And so when people say, well, where is it? I always tell them, if the same thing happened to us right now, and we fast-forwarded to the year 14,000 AD, would there be any evidence of any major city in the United States? Absolutely not. Zero. Would there be evidence that we used cell phones and had holographic, you know, images of musicians at concerts? No. There would be absolutely nothing except stories of a fantastical culture that used to exist 12,000 years ago. you know?
I think that part of it is so fascinating that you have the dynamic here of multiple centuries. You have Plato, who alluded to Atlantis. You have Edgar Cayce. You have the kid, Frederick Oliver. They're all saying, okay, this is a history that we have that we might not have any tangible proof of, but there are legends, and I think it's compelling.
Plato explicitly, in his very detailed dialogue with Critias and Timaeus, he explicitly says at the beginning, this is not a myth and this is not a legend. This is a historically accurate account that was personally vouched for by Solon, who was one of the most reputable sources of ancient Athens. And he got the story from temple priests in ancient Egypt. So again, when Cayce says that the Atlanteans went to Egypt, and then you find out that Plato got his account from a distant relative from Egypt, and then you look at water erosion, for example, around the base of the Sphinx that points to 10,500 BC. And then you look at the arrangement of the three pyramids, which point to the constellation Orion, as it would have appeared in the night sky in the year 10,500 to 10,450 BC. And it's like, it makes sense. And if we were being honest, these aren't just arbitrary coincidental dates. And when you look, as I mentioned, at the geological evidence of nano diamonds that they found all over the Earth, which suggests, according to the University of Santa Barbara, that a huge comet probably impacted in the ocean or North Atlantic ice sheet 12,000 years ago, 11,000 years ago, well, then it all actually does make perfect sense. And even Plato specifically talks about that comet. And the priest says to Solon, you know, you Greeks have a myth of Phaethon, who took his father's chariot and lost control of the horses in the sky and fell to earth as a fireball that burned up the earth. And he says, you all call this a myth, and you talk about it as like a child's story, like you would Aesop's fables or something. But he says what this really signifies is when the declinations of the planets go awry and heavenly bodies fall to earth and reset civilization, and you must begin again like children. This is what Plato says in his account of Atlantis. So he's telling you exactly what Graham Hancock gets so much flack for, which is that civilizations are occasionally reset by celestial catastrophes. What's the date Plato gives? He gives 9,600 BC for the final destruction. And again, it's right in that window when geologists believe that thing hit. And how could Plato know that in 360 BC in Athens with no access to modern geology? I find that impossibly good if that's a guess. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I like about this, is that instead of just relying only on, well, this is what our current science shows in terms of everything nuts and bolts we have to go with the way that the indigenous cultures have done with their oral histories. Nothing is written down. It's all memorized. It's given to a specific person, the storyteller, to code and remember so that they don't forget their actual history.
I always tell people, as a traditional quote-unquote historian, you know, trained in, you know, quite classic modes of history, like history of World War II or 19th and 18th century European history, like I was trained in. If you just look at the issue of World War II and you look at how that story was told 10 years after the war, 5 years after the war, 30 years after the war, today, when we find new declassified documents on the likelihood that, you know, Hitler likely did escape and flee to Argentina, according to the FBI's declassified reports that they just released, you know, 8 years ago, and other things, and other eyewitness accounts from that war that radically changed something that's in our present-day memory, you know? And so think about how difficult it really is to speak with authority on even the Crusades, you know, from 800 years ago. And so when you're talking about time spans of 12 to 15,000 years ago, written very possibly in a different language that's undecipherable, if we were to find these, records that Edgar Casey claims are still existent in an energetically protected area, three of them around the earth, would that even convince people? You know, I think it's such a difficult time scale that we really have to stop this whole smoking gun evidence needs to be produced to convince people that this is a possibility. I think the actual circumstantial evidence and just logic and deduction and the aggregate of data that's suggesting this is actually a true story is equally valid. In fact, it's the only evidence that would even, besides finding the Hall of Records or something like that, actually even be here. It would be megalithic architecture and oral traditions, or the rare account like Plato's Dialogue, which again, people don't read, so they think it's a myth. But then when you read those dialogues and you realize he's telling you it's a very historically accurate account down to the dimensions of the cities, the types of metals they use, how many people live there, what the temples look like, the names of the 10 kings. Well, when you look at that and you really unpack that story itself, just from Plato's Dialogues, as I do in the book, you find quite a bit of evidence, you know? In fact, you find the only kind of evidence that would really exist after such a long time and such a unprecedented, horrifying catastrophe, the likes of which, thank God, we in the modern day have never, you know, had to experience. So it's very difficult for us to imagine how a comet could hit the Earth during the Ice Age and precipitate a global flood because, you know, we don't live in that world right now. We live in the world that came after that.
There's a lot to be said for some of the other traditions who have their stories of origin. You know, where do we come from? They look to the stars and say the star brothers and sisters. That isn't just a one-off. That's multiple cultures who say their origins were not on this planet.
Yeah, and that's actually a very good point because that's not a topic that can be ignored with not just native indigenous origin myths from North America, South America, Australia, but also the story of Atlantis. And, you know, it's very interesting because if you look at, for example, I believe it's the Kituwa tribe from Oklahoma, you know, in their foundational myth, that's exactly what they say. They say we came from the star people, and they also talk about we used to come from a city far off in the east that had huge metal buildings, high technology, and at one point a group of people flew across the sky very fast in a flying disc and attacked another city and came back, and after that our city was destroyed in a huge technologically advanced war. And this is a Native American culture from Oklahoma thing.
Michael LaFlemme, Visions of Atlantis. A short break.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Visions of Atlantis, Michael's website, michaellaflemme.com.
The older cultures, their stories connect the dots.
They do. And, you know, it surprised me how many Native American myths allude to, not just Native American, but also Aztec, Maya, who allude to Atlantis. And I always tell people, it's hidden in plain sight. You know, according to Plato, you know, the principal city, the capital, which everybody always thinks is Atlantis, which I have a big problem with, because according to Plato, the principal landmass was a large island, which is debatable how large. I would say maybe roughly the size of three quarters of the size, or possibly the size of, say, Spain today, off the coast, you know, of Spain or Portugal, take your pick, probably where the Azores are right now, probably where the Mid-Atlantic Ridge is, along with surrounding islands. And it was an archipelago. It was a military empire at the time of the final destruction, because I believe there were three, and the larger continent, which is now visible if you look at a map on my website, second map on the top picture, shows a picture of the ocean, Atlantic Ocean, drained of water, shows all the contours. And you see a enormous continent that goes down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and the Continental Shelf. So there you go. There's the continent. But by the time Plato was writing about it, he only had the story of the final breakup, which by 10,000 BC, according to Edgar Cayce, it was just these three large islands, one of which had a famous circular city with three or four moats around it and ornate megalithic architecture with a temple in the middle. So everybody always thinks, where's the circular city? You know, that's Atlantis. It's like saying, like, London is the British Empire. It's like, no, this is a global superpower that had a capital that happened to have a circular, you know, city. But it's amazing how many, for example, the Aztecs, you know, the word Aztec comes from the word Azteca. And many scholars, including, you know, people that study just that culture, have said the most likely definition of Azteca is the people from Aztlan. And again, where does this word come from? Aztlan. You know, they're talking about the same place. And the Greek god, Titan, who held up the world on his shoulders, is Atlas. What are the chances that the Aztecs have their own god who holds up the world on his shoulders called Atlanteotl? I mean, these are cultures that are never supposed to have had any contact pre-Columbus. And yet, pre-Columbus, they both are talking about a god with the Atlan, Atlas prefix that holds the world on its shoulders.
I think the language is key.
And what's even more bizarre is to join those two. So you have Atlanteotl in Aztec, you know, cosmology. You have Atlas. You have the Atlantic Ocean in the middle of these two cultures. And then in Frederick Oliver's 1886 channeled book, A Dweller on Two Planets, happens to find a line where he's channeling this person who's speaking to him. And how interesting that he says, he's reminiscing on the decline. And he says something like, alas, like poor Atlan, you know, which beheld the world on its shoulders in terms of art and science. And then it clicked. There you go. Atlas was not some mythological character that we look at and say, oh, that's like Zeus or Hera or something, like some silly god. It was a symbolic representation of a culture that represented the apex of human achievement. And so that's why it holds the world on its shoulders. And then I see that quote in a book from a 17-year-old kid who was not a etymologist or anthropologist, and you connect the dots. And it's like, well, what would have to be in between the Atlantic Ocean, between Greece and Mexico, for these two disparate cultures to be worshiping the same Titan? Well, they probably all came from the same place, you know, which used to be a huge continent, which, again, you can see on the map on my website. If anybody thinks, you know, the Atlantic Ocean is just some bottomless pit, it's not. It's an enormous 100-mile-wide mountain range that runs down the middle of it. It's a series of just cartoonifications, if you want to call it that, Disneyfications, misinterpretations, and then the disingenuousness of the academic community who just does not want to even engage with it. Because if they really did, they would be forced to at least say, well, this is just as compelling as any other oral tradition that we say is real. You know, like, I don't know, people thought the city of Troy was fake until it was dug out of the ground in the 19th century. And it had all the characters that were in, you know, the story from Greek antiquity that everybody thought was a fable. They found King Priam's tomb, you know? So it's like, have we excavated every inch of this earth? No, we haven't even excavated more than probably 5% of the Giza plateau around the pyramid. So who's to say that there is no evidence? I think there's actually a lot more work to be done.
I think you've laid the groundwork. And I love the website. The sources for your book, you include those for anybody who wants to do a little bit more research, background research. Fortunately, you've done the heavy-duty lifting.
You know, it didn't feel like heavy lifting. It really didn't. I don't write books that feel that way because they never come out well. You know, they feel very turgid or very, like, just matter-of-fact. You know, and even though I had to include a lot of, you know, academic sources, and at times there are some chapters that get a little bit dense because of just, you know, the nature of describing technology that we have no reference to, it becomes pretty dense. It was a very enjoyable experience because, as I always tell people, I did not write this book with any goal. I did not write this to prove or disprove. I actually wrote this as a completely objective observer that did not care what I found. I just wanted to see for myself. And so in the process, I, you know, made my own conclusions, but I never put those really in the book, or I never really even suggest that anybody should or should not accept, for example, channeling. I just show what has been documented to the best of my ability and include some rare sources and then collate all of this data so that you can take a look for yourself. I mean, again, I opened the book with the quote from Socrates, you know, I know one thing, that I know nothing. And I really internally believe that. I don't think anybody knows anything. I think we're all just adding to the bigger picture with any historical subject. And I'm very wary of listening to anybody that conclusively says, I found XYZ. Like, what did you really find?
In all fairness, when we do look at history, there isn't one story. There are multiple stories because we are a civilization and we are not all in the same place at the same time. So we have different viewpoints, different experiences, different awarenesses. And that's, I think, what you have tried to pull together here by giving these sources that you've included as potential resources and maybe more authentic information.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I look at it like, you know, if I were painting a picture or something, it's like the canvas and the base paint are not controversial. I'm using anthropology journals, genetic evidence, cultural stories, oral traditions, mainstream findings, oceanography. And then, like, the colors are just the clairvoyant stuff. It fills in, adds a vividness to these accounts that I don't just believe is fictional. I actually think it's, like Edgar Cayce said, depending on the ability, state of mind at the time, and the surrounding audience while he was in these sessions, the fidelity of the channeling could be either higher or lower. But it's not even to me a question of, like, was this person really wearing this and had this name in Atlanta? That's irrelevant. What's important are the trends that come up again and again and again daily.
In terms of this book, and what caught my interest was the fact you did use the esoteric material. The dweller on two planets, and for him to have at that time, you know, my gosh, Old West, when we have outdoor plumbing. you have to put the time frame in there and figure, how did he come up with Atlantis? And channeling and automatic writing, that's outstanding.
Yeah, it's really difficult. It's really difficult to explain that book. The only thing I will say is there was a book written in 1882 called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. And it became a bestseller, and, you know, he became famous for that book later. But even if Frederick Oliver had gotten a copy of that book when he was 14 years old or something like that, the likelihood that he could have plugged in the gaps that he plugged in is almost zero. And the technology he's describing in A Dweller on Two Planets, which is, to me, and I've looked very hard, it's the first time probably in that subfield of Atlantis research where the high technology description had ever been used. You know, they're very common now. It's very normal for people to talk about there were flying machines, there were crystals, there was this, there were energy weapons. But that all started with Frederick Oliver. And I wanted to show people that, you know, it was Casey after Oliver. But it was Oliver who was, to my knowledge, you know, prove me wrong, was the first person in 1886 to elaborately describe how the technology of this civilization worked. And for a 17-year-old kid, even if it, I say this in the book, look, let's just presume it's fiction. How do you account for this then? Because then this person is on a level of Albert Einstein, Nikola Tesla with some of the things he's talking about, you know? And that's strange enough, which is why I do believe he was clairaudiently channeling this voice in his head from Mount Shasta that was talking about his past life in Atlantis. And I really believe that. As strange as that sounds, it's stranger to think he just made this all up, put it in the drawer, never shared it with anybody, and died before it was published. Like, why would you do that? You know, you would do that if this was a series of crappy notes or something. That's not what this is. Yeah. It's a Shakespearean drama that includes an internal physics, a definition of magnetism, catholicity, electricity, you know, an internal war. I mean, he could have sold this book and been the first Tolkien, but he didn't do that. He put it in a drawer because that's what his preceptor that he claims he was channeling told him to do. And when the time was right, this book would be revealed and, you know, inform humanity. So it's very weird. Very weird.
Well, the website, I love the website, michaellaflemme.com, Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy, the clouds and the lightning and all the visuals you've included. Yeah. It's striking.
Yes, it's very dramatic. And, you know, I didn't choose those pictures on it at the top, just off the top of my head. You know, it's kind of like a little puzzle. If you've read the book, you can recognize some characters, perhaps, or some technology from that time. So on the website, there's some views of the book, a link to buy it, a link to my Patreon, which I absolutely appreciate all subscribers. As a self-published author who, you know, actually lives off my book sales. Also, yeah, some great links to some other people's websites. Christopher Dunn's website, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, fascinating accounts of what was really going on in Giza, as well as some primary sources that I use, some books from the 19th century that are kind of hard to find, but that were scanned and in the public records. So I put those up there for you. You can read A Dweller on Two Planets yourself if you, you know, want to lose your mind.
You're right. It is dense, epic dense.
Would you believe it if I told you I read that book 9 times?
Oh, yeah, because to just go in and, you know, can find a way to make it coherent and concise,
yeah.
There's a lot to it.
Of all the novels and books I've read in my day, it remains one of my favorites. There's something about it that's so real, you know, even if you view it purely as fiction and you don't believe in channeling.
Are you going to do another book?
That's a great question. You know, this one took so much out of me that I really want this one to sink in for at least the rest of the year. And I want to do some follow-up, you know, field work of myself. I think there is a follow-up at some point, you know. I have to feel it out, see where it takes me. Because, you know, I'd never intended to write this one. It just kind of came to me, kind of like the way Dweller on Two Planets came to Frederick Oliver. And that's a true story. You know, that's not something I just say for fun. So if that comes to me again, yeah, you can count on this one. But for now, you know, you got 400 pages of some pretty interesting material, and I would never want to half-ass another book just to get, you know, another one out there. I think the way I work, it's takes a long time. I'm very careful what I say when I know it's going out to potentially the whole world. And so, yeah, I think eventually, yeah, absolutely, there will be another book, but I just need a little more perspective to see what's going to happen.
You've opened some new territory. This is new ground, and I'm so glad that this is adding more to the equation of why don't we research some of the people who have had this other information, esoteric information, that might add to what we think right. We already know.
Well, and you know, another thing that I should add that was kind of my intention with this book was really just to be, like I said, kind of an expert curator of a subject, and you know, to not just speak to people that already quote unquote believed in this subject, but to have a book that any human being at any point in their academic, you know, ability or historical knowledge could pick up and read front to back and not feel either overwhelmed or just like this is simplistic, because there are parts of the book that are extremely complicated, but then there are also parts of the book where you're reading, you know, a crazy Atlantean love story that reads like fiction but is presumably true. And so I think it's many books in one, but it's, you know, to me, an easy read because it's not just dry information and footnotes. It's an actual story. You know, we go through time. We go from Plato to right now. And then at the end, you see that the way that the world is configured today is actually very similar to the final stages of Atlantis. The powers that be have really not changed. And so that story that seems like a kind of, you know, fantasy or this inconsequential, you know, anecdote from some Greek philosopher, it takes on a new meaning because you realize we very likely are not just the inheritors of that culture, but we possibly were actually alive at that time. And we perhaps have not even learned fundamental lessons from that time period, you know, because in many of those destructions, not just the final one, they were human caused and they were misapplications of a supremely powerful technology. You know, and you look at around at the world today more than ever, and you think we have technology that can alter the weather. We have technology that can destroy the planet. We have all sorts of things. We have AI. We have you name it. And are we really mature enough to, you know, harness that power? And so to me, it's a nice tie-in because I think it's a very timely lesson, if nothing else. It's a cautionary tale of what happens with, you know, high technology, free will, and, you know, the old good and evil, if you believe in such a thing, conceit that's very obviously playing out in 2023, you know, in a variety of ways. So I think it's a very modern story, even though it's probably 12,000 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. I have more respect for comets.
Yeah, me too. Again, nothing we can do about that, you know? You know, if people think that's unlikely, I remind them in, 1907, comet hit, exploded in midair over Tunguska, Siberia, and that had hit New York City or London, we would be talking about comets because it obliterated hundreds of square miles, had hundreds of times more power than an atomic bomb, you know? And that was 120 years ago, almost, you know, 115 years ago. That wasn't millions of years ago. So it could happen, you know, and I tell people in the book, like, we really need to get over these age-old differences, culture, race, this, that, political spectrum, and look at the past that we've survived and try to get through it this time, you know, because it's like Dolores Cannon says, this is a school, nothing more. You come to learn lessons. Well, we have a lot of lessons to learn, I think, you know?
Well, it says saving the environment is actually a priority because if there is a catastrophe, then we're going to right. have a planet that's healthy for us to recoup.
Yeah. And it's, I think, also helpful to have, you know, a sense of human community so that the survivors can actually find a common humanity and have a culture that's worth rebooting. You know, I would take it that far.
Yeah.
You know, God there was some good people in Atlantis that preserved that knowledge that was rebooted in places like Egypt, from which the Greeks derived most of their culture, which we inherited, you know? So, I mean, just on that logical channel, it's like we are direct descendants of Atlantis if Plato is telling the truth. And as I tell people quite flippantly, you know, if it's between some blogger and Plato, I'm going with Plato, you know, as a source. Who are you to presume that Plato is a fool? This is one of the greatest thinkers in Western canon. You would never say Aristotle was making things up. I always tell people, you know, respect, like you said, respect oral traditions. Just because they're told by a village elder in a small tribe does not mean that they're any less reliable than what we admit as evidence today.
For anybody who wants information from you, you've got the website, michaellaflamme.com. Audible, the book is available as an audiobook. It's excellent.
Thank you. And I have links to contact me. If anybody has a question or wants to set up an interview, you can go through the website and have my Facebook and social media links. I'm always excited to see what people think about the book. Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Michael's website, michaellaflamme.com. Excellent review from Lisa Hagen, literary agent, publisher. She says it's a well-researched and fascinating page-turner. Links are in the description for the show. Thanks for listening.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.